Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, or MCLA, President James Burge. Dr. Jamie Burge, has worked in higher education for more than 30 years. He spent much of his early career in the student affairs area, followed by work with faculty and staff to integrate community-based learning into academic course objectives. Burge has worked in public and private higher education, as well as with the Association of Academic Presidents. Most recently, his work has been in private higher education. After serving as Executive Vice President and Interim President at Wheeling Jesuit University in West Virginia, Burge was recruited to become the fourth president at Franklin Pierce University in New Hampshire in 2009. While at Franklin Pierce, Burge and his leadership team achieved much success, including securing the largest single donor gift in university history, the largest planned gift in history, four of the six largest annual fund contributions in history, and completing the comprehensive capital campaign Above Goal. They also expanded undergraduate academic majors to include health science, business, environmental studies, public health, and social media and emergent technologies, and established new graduate degrees, including the Master's of Physician Assistant Studies, MBA in Sustainability, as well as an MBA in Health Administration and Nursing. His team expanded athletic programs to include sprint football, track and cross country, women's ice hockey, women's bowling, and women's golf. He increased admissions applications by 40%, incoming class size by 15%, and student retention by 8 percentage points. Burge also oversaw construction of the Pappas Center for Health Science and Athletic Training, the Visagia Memorial Softball Complex, and the Kirsch Baseball Clubhouse, and implemented a faculty governance model, as well as faculty participation on the Academic Affairs Committee of the Board of Trustees. Burge holds a PhD in Leadership Studies from Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, a master's in guidance and counseling from Plymouth State University in New Hampshire, and a BS in elementary education from Westfield State University in Massachusetts. We'll talk with James Burge about all of this and much more, but first of all, welcome MCLA President Dr. James Burge.
Thank you, Alan. It's good to be here.
And it's good to see you here. So let's start. I was fascinated, and I have to start with this, that you were at a Catholic university in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of my experience had been in Jesuit higher education. I'd worked at a number of other institutions. Gonzaga is a Jesuit institution, and it was a form of education that really appealed to me early in my career, and so I worked in a number of institutions.
But that's not why I want to talk to you about Wheeling, West Virginia. I want to talk to you about Wheeling, West Virginia because of the music, phenomenal country music.
Right, that's right.
And we used to get it in New York City, believe it or not.
No kidding.
It's a super station down there, and I would listen to it. Did you ever get to hear any of that good country music?
Oh, of course. Yeah, we heard it. And they have a big jamboree every summer just outside of the city. And I haven't actually been to the jamboree, but you hear lots of great music and lots of great musicians and bands move through the area.
Do you play music?
I do not. I played in the band in high school, but not anymore.
What'd you play?
The trumpet.
Me too.
Is that right?
Yeah, in high school. And
trumpet players, very special people.
They really are. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Were your parents religious?
Yeah, I was raised Catholic. Both my parents were Catholic. My oldest sister is a nun. So yeah, that was a big part of my upbringing.
So college jobs and these administrative jobs follows right along, right? Because you were interested in Jesuit education.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I didn't start my career thinking that I was going to work in Catholic higher education. In fact, I started my career at public institutions. But a move to Colorado to follow my wife and her career.
What was her career?
Her career was in student affairs and higher ed as well.
Oh, I see.
And so she went to work at Regis University in Denver, which is a Jesuit school. And so, of course, I followed her, worked at the University of Colorado at Boulder for a while, but then actually went to Regis because I liked the mission. They had an opening of a job that I really liked. So that really was my first exposure to Jesuit education.
Were you the trailing spouse?
I was.
Mm-hmm. For those people who are listening, often when a married couple goes somewhere, the husband or the wife comes and they're known as the trailing spouse.
That's right.
Right. Let's go back to the beginning. What did your father do for a living?
My father worked for the Social Security Administration.
Really?
He did. And so we moved around a good bit in New England, mostly in Massachusetts, some in Maine.
What did he do?
He was a district assistant manager in Pittsfield, actually, was where he retired.
That's where I went to sign up.
Yeah, in fact, the office is still there. Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to go and visit him there.
Tell him God bless him.
Yeah, okay. I wish I could. He's not here anymore.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
And your mom?
My mom was a teacher early in her career, but I have an older sister and a twin sister.
You have a twin sister?
I have a twin sister.
I have a twin brother.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, look at all the confluence
here. How about that? Yeah, right. Trumpets and twins. Right?
Yeah, there we go.
So when my older sister, Mary-Kate, was born, my mom stopped teaching and raised her family. So.
And your older sister, Mary-Kate, is now a nun.
She is, a sister of St. Joseph, and she actually is an associate professor of theology at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, Maryland.
Did you talk to her at the point at which she was thinking about becoming a nun?
You know, I was a very young man at that point, probably was still in college, I'm sure I was. And so I was aware of, you know, and so I talked with her about it. But
was there pressure on you to be a priest?
None. I thought about it. You know, there was a very charismatic priest in my home parish, St. Mary's in Lee, who when I was
in Lee, Mass.
When I was a junior in high school, I had a friend who was much older. He was a friend of a contemporary of my grandparents, actually. And he died, and it was a hard time for me. And so this parish priest was very good to help me understand more about death. It was my first experience with death of somebody close to me. And I thought, boy, you know, that was really, had a really quite an impact on me. So for a little while, I thought about the priesthood, but ultimately.
What dissuaded you?
I guess at that time, you know, I was young. I was 17, 18. And I guess when I went off to college, I thought, you know, the priestly life was too staid a life for me. I wanted more excitement. And so I decided not to pursue that.
But your parents didn't?
None at all. No pressure at all from my parents to do that, no. I think they would have been very pleased, but they wanted each of us to find our own path and be happy with it. They really didn't pressure us in any way.
So here you are, the president of, you know, a dynamic, growing institution, which really has, under you and your predecessor, Mary Grant, done extremely well. It's reinvented itself, hasn't it?
Very much so. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, I grew up in Lee, Mass, and I knew the institution as North Adams State College at the time, a very different place. And then I left the Berkshires for about a 30-year period to start my career. And when I came back for this role, I had known that the institution had changed its mission and its name, but I really didn't know much more about it until I started interviewing for the position. But it has transformed in many ways. And as you mentioned, Mary Grant was phenomenal at the work that she did. She left an institution that was a much stronger, a much more reputable institution than what I knew the institution at 30 years prior. And it is that. I mean, in many ways, it lives up to the quality of our faculty, the kinds of students that we draw in, the mission of liberal arts and integrating the Liberal Arts Foundation with professional programs, the kinds of speakers that we bring to campus. It's a remarkable institution in many ways.
So when you interviewed for the job, this is always interesting to me. Clearly, they must have been very impressed by the amount of money you'd been able to bring in to these other institutions you were working in. But this is a public institution. Is there a lines converging between the public and the private in terms of fundraising?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are. And I think that in many ways, you know, the processes are similar. I think the dynamic is different. I think in many ways, alums of public institutions don't necessarily think about philanthropy the way that alums from private institutions do, at least toward the alma mater. And so I think, you know, we're in the process of helping our alumni understand the importance of giving back to the institution to support our current students, just as perhaps they were supported when they were students there. But now it's their time to support our students. So
now, when I went to Hunter College in the Bronx at the time, I paid zero. Free education. Is that a good idea, free education? Because, I had classmates, I've said it often, who if you told them that they had to pay $100 for that education, they couldn't have done it.
Yeah,
and
right.
A lot of them have done spectacularly well.
Sure.
So have we missed the boat on all of this?
I don't know. You know, someone paid for it. You went, as you said, without paying anything, but somebody paid for it.
Yeah, the government paid for it. Just like the government pays for the kindergarten, elementary school, high school. Let me just give you the speech. If we're talking about equality of opportunity, even the Republicans talk about equality of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So then how can you have equality of opportunity if you don't have the same free education at the college level or even the graduate level that you have back in high school?
Well, I don't disagree by any means. I think that making higher education more accessible should be one of the priorities for our country. And it's just not. You know, I don't think it's a priority. priority for most states. You know, in Massachusetts, we're fortunate the legislature does provide resources for us. And we have a higher percentage of support from our legislature than many other institutions. About a third of our revenue comes from the state through the appropriation. But it still doesn't cover the total cost of education by any means. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to consider as a country, what is important to us? What is the priority? And it should be higher education, because it's not just about educating people so that they have a job. You know, certainly people, and frequently parents, I just talked with a group of parents who were on campus for orientation to say that, you know, most parents that I talked to, and it was true of this group, think about an education as a means to getting a job for their son or daughter.
Without question. But and when you, by the way, I have found in 40 years of teaching at New Paltz and Rutgers and Albany, I have found that it is the number one thing, not only on the parents' minds, but on the kids' minds, too.
Yeah, without question, without question. But the reality is, when you look at the outcomes of someone who's been educated well with a college degree, whether it's an undergrad or graduate, there are many, many greater benefits to that education than just a job. Now, certainly the job is good, but, you know, think about a job. It's not about getting money, but they're also become taxpayers. So they support the base of operations for communities. Educated people who have college education are healthier. So there's less of a drain on the healthcare system. Big topic today, right? People who are educated are much more likely to participate in electoral politics. So they vote more. They're more engaged in the life of politics. They're much more likely to volunteer. They become coaches. They run for office at the local level. So there are many great outcomes from education other than just getting a job. That's important. I understand the importance of that. You know, I have a daughter who's graduated from college and two others in school.
Where did she go to school?
Kate went to Regis University in Denver.
Okay.
And she's now a fourth grade teacher.
Right. But I think there's a distinct difference between teaching at Williams or going to Williams College and going to Hunter or MCLA. I think kids have, especially if they're first generation college kids, have different priorities.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they come in with those different priorities. But if you were to look at the life histories of people that graduate from Hunter or Williams or MCLA, you'll find a lot of similarity. And it will be all of those things that I talked to. They're more engaged in the life of their communities. They're more knowledgeable about world events and national events. All of those outcomes that we want people to be aware of. I think that transcends any level of education, or I should say type of institution that offers the education, whether you're at Williams or MCLA.
I'm not so sure.
You're not sure?
No, I feel pretty strongly about that. You know, I know you do, but I'm not so sure because, you know, I've had to do with people at private institutions and or independent, as they like to be called, or public institutions, and I get a different feeling. I mean, it's one thing if your education is going to cost $60,000 or $70,000 a year now, and your parents can afford that. There's a sort of a segregation, an economic segregation that takes place that doesn't exist really at state universities.
Well, I think that you're right. I mean, there is a different kind of student that goes to Williams than typically comes to MCLA, although we do get students who transfer to MCLA from Williams.
You know, I hear you.
So there's certainly a distinction there. But I think the effect of the education that they get, especially at a liberal arts institution, to ask probative questions, to consider, to be contemplative about the life that you want to lead or what the life is like in your community. I think if we explored this together more fully, we'd find more similarities in those outcomes among the students from those different institutions than the differences, particularly related to those outcomes that I talked about a moment ago.
We're talking with Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts President Dr. Jamie Burge. So what's it like to be a college president? I mean, for example, I saw one of the things that we read earlier when we introduced you was that you had come up with a college governance plan. But I've always thought, in my heart of hearts, college governance is a bunch of baloney. I think what happens is the president comes in, they've got a vision. You know, the idea is to get the faculty to go along with you. And in my experience, you know, faculty meetings and faculty didn't really amount to a hill of beans. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know if your experience or observations are wrong. I think they're different than mine. You know, presidents certainly have a responsibility to be visionary and to bring new ideas. I'm sure that when the Board of Trustees interviewed me and ultimately selected me, they thought, here's someone who's going to come in and move us forward. And I think in many ways we've done that this year. But I think ultimately the things that have worked really well this year and the things that are going to work well for us in the future, we've just finished a strategic planning process. are going to be better and stronger because we've had the voice of faculty and staff and students, frankly.
Give me an example. Places.
So, for example, the strategic planning process. We had a steering committee of, I guess, maybe 13 or 15 people, but there were task forces that looked at different goals. So at the end of all of this, 60 people from around the institution were involved in crafting this strategic plan. I think it's stronger because of that. People feel more ownership for it. They know where we're headed, what direction we're headed in. And so that strengthens the planning process and, as a result, the results of that plan and the things that we'll implement. That comes directly because we had wise, smart people literally around the table helping to craft what that means. And it takes longer. There's no question. It takes longer to engage people in a process than if somebody comes in, a president just says, this is the way it's going to be. But it's a better product, whatever that might be, whether it's a strategic plan or a new academic program.
Give me a concrete example of a political scientist or a sociologist or an economist who helped you put something into that strategic plan that might not have been there without faculty input.
Yeah, so I think that I think we need new academic programs. So I came in and I said, you know, we need to think about some new majors. Well, as a result of the strategic plan, so I just said, you know, here's where I think we want to go, and I have some specific ideas about what we need to do.
That's why presidents need to be leaders.
That's right, and there's no question that at times presidents and I have had to use the bully pulpit to say, you know, here's the way things are going to go. I think it's an important tool, but it should be used carefully and rarely, frankly. But back to the example. So I think we need more academic programs or new academic programs. And so as a result of the planning process, one of the things that came out of that from the voices of my colleagues in the faculty and others on the staff were not just to say, okay, let's start picking these, but to say, let's define a process for how we discern which academic programs we'll create.
So let's put a face on it. Give me a couple of those. We mentioned them in the beginning, but give me a couple of the new academic programs that you think are relevant to higher education today.
Well, you know, when you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data on the top 10 fastest growing fields, I think 6 of those 10 are in health professions. So we haven't had health professions programs at MCLA. We've had science programs, biology and chemistry, which frequently prepare students to go on to health professions graduate programs. But we don't have anything that really prepares them for specifically those programs. So just last week, in fact, I was at the Board of Higher Education in Massachusetts with a proposal which they approved for us to create 2 new academic programs. One is a community health education. So thinking about how do we educate students to be advocates for people who are consumers of healthcare, working in policy positions to kind of craft better healthcare programs. So we'll have an academic program that students can major in to become policymakers regarding healthcare. So that's one example. There will be more that I think we can do because we have great facilities on campus. As you know, we have one brand new science center. It's roughly 4
Very
years
impressive,
old.
Yeah.
The Feigenbaum Center for Science and Innovation, and a fairly significant $15 million renovation of Bowman Hall. Both facilities create an opportunity and a capacity for us to offer different academic programs than we have in the past. So I think because of that opportunity, because of that capacity, we can offer new academic programs. And I think as a result of this planning process that I mentioned, we'll be able to come up with an infrastructure for how to vet or discern what kind of programs we should have.
Okay, let's go back to the concept of faculty governance. I want to talk to you about your responsibilities. Suppose you get to be the president of MCLA or any other higher education institution, and people start whispering in your ear, this guy's no damn good. He's been here for, I don't mean you, I mean some faculty member, been here forever, has been turning over the yellow pieces of paper, you know, is not an inspiring professor. I hear it all the time. I look at the evaluations. What do you do?
Well, you know, governance has a system for that, for addressing those things. And
it's pretty self-protecting, isn't it? I mean, I always found it to be so.
Well, I think it can be, certainly. But I've also seen those governance systems also be responsive to those kinds of things.
But those guys, when you see such a person, that person has survived all the vetting from those committees for years.
Yeah, that's true. But let's also not discount that person, though she or he may be teaching from the yellowed pages and may not be as participatory in college service and things like that, that person has an expertise that's been created over a lifetime,
maybe,
and that's valuable.
Maybe. Jamie, maybe not.
That's true. That's true. Sometimes that's the case.
In other words, the word's on the street about professors, right? You know, this guy's great. This guy stinks.
There is some of that, but you also have to look at the data carefully about, you know, what does that guy stinks mean, right? So
is it a lousy teacher? He can't impart information. He hasn't learned anything for 20 years, and he's just turning over the pieces of paper. Whereas somebody down the hall is a fairly young, new, innovative person. They're going to teach me how to get ahead in life.
Right. Well, I think there is a spectrum of quality of faculty, certainly, that, you know, students more than anybody probably know. But I think with regard to that faculty member that is tired and perhaps isn't being as effective as she or he has been in the past, you know, we do need to talk about those things. And there are processes for do that. So
what are the processes?
So one is to talk about some professional development. What might this person need to kind of re-energize him or herself about his or her discipline?
How's that done? You bring him into your office and sit him down and say, hey, you a little tired?
It could be as simple as that, to say, you know, we've noticed either through your evaluations or maybe some colleagues' comments that you don't seem to be as engaged in the teaching and learning process as you have been. What's up?
Well, they look you in the eye and they say, hey, what are you talking about? I'm tenured. You have no right to talk to me this way.
Oh, absolutely. We have a right to talk that way. We're not doing anything other than talking, right? And so I think we can point out that on occasion, and I would say it's very rare when this happens, to say, you know, the teaching is not adequate. And having the evidence, the data to suggest that is either through peer review or from student evaluations, to say, but we want to help you be more effective. What can we do to help you be more effective in the learning and teaching process? I think that's always the better approach, is to engage that person to say, what can we do together to help improve the effectiveness of that teaching and learning dynamic? And more often than not, I've seen that work. On occasion, it doesn't. And sometimes the result is that that faculty member is no longer teaching.
But you can't fire them, can you?
Sure you can.
Because tenure means continuing employment. It doesn't mean that.
Right. Yeah, but it doesn't mean you can do anything. And so there are times when a faculty member behaves in such a way where you have to say, you know, that's not appropriate with, or consistent with the values of the institution and can no longer be here. And I've had to do that, unfortunately. It's rare, but I've unfortunately had to do that.
What about unions? Unions always played a big part in higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Is their power waxing or waning?
You know, I think right now it's waxing. I think there has been kind of a general assault on higher education. And in particular, I think there have been some criticisms, unfair criticisms of faculty. And so I think that the number of unions have been increasing and strengthening. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. You know, I think for there to be some collective ideas about how people, a group of people want to do their work is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, it creates some challenges sometimes when you're talking about personnel matters or human resource policies. You have to kind of manage, you know, sometimes competing interests, but they're certainly manageable. I mean, unions and management have worked on these things for centuries.
What keeps you up at night, Jamie Burge?
Well, you know, I think about right now our national climate is tenuous, I think. I really worry about that. You know, we're seeing it on the campus at MCLA and other institutions about how the recent presidential campaign, the rhetoric, just, I think, enhanced the marginalization of certain populations of students and of anybody, certain populations. And I worry about that. I'm deeply concerned about the issues related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so I do think about that a lot. I think about, you know, pragmatic things about the safety of our students. Most of our students are the traditional age students, and sometimes, you know, when we were that age, we didn't make the best decisions. And I worry sometimes that students don't make the right decisions, and they might be unsafe. I always worry about that.
For example?
Well, you know, sometimes students make decisions about alcohol and drugs, and they get into trouble physically, medically.
Yeah.
And I really worry about that. It is unfortunate that there have been some students at institutions where I've been the president who have died. And to have the conversation with parents that their child has died is heartbreaking. And, you know, I don't want to have any more of those. And so I worry about that. And I think that's why it's important for us to make sure we're doing the things that we should do to help students make decisions. Well, making sure that, you know, we've got the proper protections on campus for, you know, good policing on campus to keep the campuses safe, that we have communications devices available so we can communicate with students or they can communicate with us if they're in need, having good policies about alcohol and drugs, providing really good personal counseling and health care for our students. We have a counseling and healthcare center on campus. So making those things available for students so that they can address and try and mitigate some of those health issues that they may have. but also doing what we do best, educating students about making good choices when it comes to all sorts of things. So, you know, even though I think we do a very good job of that, in particular at MCLA and in general in higher education, it's still a worry. You know, it's still, you have that dimension of young people sometimes making decisions that they shouldn't and not realizing that there are some dire consequences on occasion.
We're talking to Dr. James Burge of the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. So, politicians, let's talk about politicians. Obviously, you're a public institution. You need the support of the local pals, the state senator, the state assemblymen or mm-hmm. women. How good are you at that?
Well, you know, I think it's about building relationships, right? It's about the interpersonal dynamic that occurs, and it's something that I like to do. I like developing those interpersonal relationships.
How do you do it?
It's about telling stories. And, you know, I have a great opportunity to talk about MCLA because there are so many things that go on there that are really good and dynamic. And so I like to talk about MCLA with people. And when they learn more about the institution, they become very excited about it. Now, it happens to be the case that we've, for a very long time, and I think much of this is credit to Mary Grant, my predecessor as the president, we've always, for many years, have had a very good relationship with our Berkshire delegation. And so that's continued. And because many of them know the institution or they come from the community and they know MCLA, you know, they've perpetuated that good relationship. So we have a great relationship with our elected senator who recently, Adam Hines, had been the director of the Northern Berkshire Community Coalition right in North Adams. So he knows us quite well. Gail Caridi, who just passed away, unfortunately, knew us for many, many years. She was a 20-year city council member. She'd been our state representative for, I think, 7 years and passed away quickly and unexpectedly just 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago. But we've had good relationships with them. Even our representatives from the Pittsfield area, Tricia Farley-Bouvier, has been very supportive of the institution. Paul Marks up in the Hill community, just really supportive of the institution. They like our students. They always host our students. You probably know Smitty Pignatelli from Lenox, the dean of the Berkshire Caucus.
Great friend of mine.
He's been great with our students, bringing them down to the Capitol.
Have you ever had contretemps with a state legislator? I mean, I knew one state legislator who tried to get me fired once. I started a newspaper in the legislature called the Legislative Gazette, and he and a chairman of a political party, local political party, went to the president and said to the president, "We want this guy fired." And the president came running to me, told me the story. He said, "What'd you say?" I said, "Well, I told him I couldn't fire you. You have tenure." Thereby being, Jamie, perhaps the first and only time I've ever heard of tenure doing exactly what it was supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, I would have liked it if he had said, I wasn't going to fire you just because somebody didn't like what you wrote. That should have been the response, not necessarily just because you have tenure.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't have been right just to terminate you.
That's what he should have said.
Yeah, right. Of course.
And of course, I don't know really what he said. I just know what he told me. He said,
right.
Yeah, so,
I don't know that I've ever had that kind of experience.
Haven't.
I mean, I haven't. I don't know if any elected official has ever thought about, you know.
But I have heard stories about elected officials who say, "Hire my brother-in-law at the college."
Yeah.
And somebody's got to stand up to that and say, "No,
right,
I'm not going to do that." Mm-hmm. And so, you know, because politicians are what they are.
Yeah, that's never been my experience. I've never had any kind of suggestion of an ultimatum to do something for a politician.
Have you ever had a request that you do something for?
I've actually requested of politicians to suggest some people. So, for example, we have an opening on our board of trustees right now. So I've talked with our elected officials to say, "Do you know of somebody that would be good for MCLA that I could talk to?"
How does that work? The governor appoints, right?
The governor appoints. So typically what happens is that in the Massachusetts state system, anyway, the state university system, for every opening, the institution can nominate two candidates, and then the governor will nominate two candidates. And so those four candidates are vetted by a committee that works with the Department of Higher Education and the governor's office, and they essentially provide background for the governor on each of those candidates, and then he, Governor Baker, makes the choice based on that. So we have an opportunity to put those candidates forward, but we don't necessarily choose our trustees. The governor does that.
Every once in a while, there's a move in Massachusetts and everywhere else, New York too, to sort of unify the higher education system so that, you know, somebody will be the important place and somebody will be the less important place and four-year college versus university center. And then part and parcel of my blue book question for you here is then inevitably somebody comes along and says, "We really have to have a common mission and we're going to lay it out at the top rather than let you guys do it on your local level." You want to talk to all of that?
Yeah, you know, I think that would be a mistake, frankly. I think one of the real strengths of the Massachusetts State University system that we're part of, so there are 9 state universities, I think one of the strengths for us is that we are distinct, that we have our own culture. You know, there are 3 of us that have a distinct mission, a special mission. MCLA is one of them. Mass Art in Boston is another. And Mass Maritime is the 3rd. So we're certainly distinct.
And what's the MCLA one again, Jamie?
Liberal arts. Oh, so the focus on liberal arts.
I see. Okay.
So I think that creates a distinction. But even at the other institutions, the Fitchburg, Westfield, Bridgewater, they have their own distinct culture. And I think that they would lose that if there was a central coordinating board for all of the institutions. You know, Carlos Santiago, who's the commissioner of higher education, has been very vocal and clear that that's not a direction that he sees us moving in. And I think we're all pleased with that because it is important for us to have our own board leadership. They direct to a certain degree some of the work that we do. They certainly direct the work that I do and the other presidents at the universities. And I think it's a healthy system because it allows us to provide a diversity of educational experience for people that don't want to go to, you know, the same institution, wherever it might be. I think it's important for us to offer that kind of difference so that people can make choices based on what they see.
When I got to New Paltz early in the game, 1971 full-time, each of the state university places, if I have this right, were told that they were going to have a particular orientation. And I believe New Paltz was going to be the African and Asian center of the university. Well, I got there and had no interest in that at all. And my colleague Jerry Benjamin and I and a couple of other people decided, since we had real interest in state government, we were going to make New Paltz, which was not Albany, which was 90 miles away from Albany, the center. We started the first internship program. And we started the Legislative Gazette. And we started all this other stuff. So sometimes this stuff really comes right out of the faculty and somebody comes into your office and says, what about this idea? Can we do this? Right? And what do you do?
Yeah, well, I think that's the benefit of working in higher education is that you've got a lot of smart people working together. And I think many good ideas come from the faculty and certainly from the staff. But the best decisions emerge from a collective of people working together on that. I'm a firm believer in that. Even though I think I'm a pretty bright guy.
Do you ever say no? I mean,
Sure. There are times when you say no, when it just seems inconsistent with the mission or we don't have the capacity to do something or it's so out of line with what we have or could do. Yeah, you say no to those things.
Well, I do remember when I started the Legislative Gazette and I went to the president and the vice president, I remember saying, oh, the only thing you're going to do is get everybody angry at us from having this newspaper up in Albany. Hmm. But they let me do it. To their great credit, they let me do it. Mm-hmm. But I had to really fight for it during that time. Turned out they were right, of course. It did get them into trouble. Nevertheless.
But that wasn't the only outcome. I mean, there were good things that came out of that.
Oh, my God,
Gazette.
Yes.
Yeah. So generation, sometimes you have to weigh those things.
Yeah, generations of journalists and others who have come out of that program. Yeah.
So great things. And, you know, not all good ideas go smoothly, right? You know, sometimes there's a bumpy road to some good ideas that emerge. But when the day is done and you look back at what you've done, you have to weigh that. Certainly there, you know, there was some pressure or tension for the president and the provost for making that, allowing you to do those things. But there were many good things that came from that. And you shouldn't discount that, Alan. You got to talk about those things.
What does a good provost do compared to a good president?
Well, the provost is the chief academic officer. And so that person should really have a very strong relationship with the faculty, should be very aware of academic freedom and protecting that. Making sure that students are getting the kind of education that I and others say that they're going to get, and so assuring that quality and experience.
When you say the chief academic officer compared to what you do, it seems to me you're the chief academic officer. They may be responsible for certain parts of the program, but I've always bridled at the idea that the provost is the chief academic officer when you got a president whose vision is obviously very important.
Well, in higher education, we like titles, right? And so I think that, and in many cases, that you know that person who's the provost or the vice president for academic affairs has emerged from the ranks of the faculty, which in and of itself likes the idea of titles, lecturer, assistant, associate professor. And so there's an extension of that culture of titles. And also, I think it's a way for the faculty to feel like they own that person, they own that decision maker, policy maker, as the chief academic officer.
But you're not saying that that provost is their representative to you rather than the other way around? In other words, if that officer is a manager, I would take it you would hope that when you come out and say, okay, this is what I want to achieve here, that that officer will bring that back to the faculty, not necessarily the other way around.
That's true. And I think that's what makes the provost's role really difficult, in some ways more difficult than the president, because there are two populations the provost is serving, essentially the president of the institution and perhaps even other executive leaders at the institution and the faculty members. And so I think it is a difficult role for
someone. Well, now Donald Trump told James Comey, apparently, I demand absolute loyalty from you. Do you demand absolute loyalty from your number two?
No, I don't. In fact, I think the best staffs that I've been part of when I've been the president are staffs that have been willing to step forward and challenge me on my thinking. I think the most ineffective people are yes people, just saying yes to a boss or a supervisor. I think the strength of my experience has emerged from others being willing to challenge me on either decisions that I've made or directions I think we should be going in. And in some cases, I've changed my direction or my decision because of that. But ultimately, when we're done with whatever the topic might be, I expect the provost or any of the other vice presidents that work with me to support the decision. But when we're together making decisions, making policy, thinking about directions, I expect them to bring the full weight of their intellect and their knowledge about the culture of the institution to bear on whatever we're talking about.
How about the media? We've talked about your relationship with politicians. Now let's talk about the media. How important are they to the functioning of your institution?
Well, I think that they're important to us in a variety of ways. One is that, you know, we produce journalists. Right. You know, we have a communications major, English communications, and we've done a very good job of educating new journalists. In fact, if you were to go to the Berkshire Eagle, which is our local great paper, by the way.
I did want to get into that. Yeah.
You know, you'll find many MCLA alums who are there, and not just alums. They, in fact, the Eagle uses some of our current students to staff some of their positions because they're good. So on one hand, the media is tremendously important because they're employers of our graduates.
Oh, come on now, Jamie. There must be a day that, you know, something happens on the campus, somebody overdoses or something happens, and you say, oh, my God, they're going to kill us in this piece.
Yeah, you know, we think about those things, but I'm less concerned about the coverage in and of itself because, you know, we're a public institution and the media should cover things like that. What frustrates me about the media is sometimes when they get stories wrong or incomplete.
How often does that happen?
I think it's rare. But it happens occasionally.
What do you do when it happens?
You try to correct it.
Call them up?
Yep. I've called up media outlets before to say, I think you got it wrong, or you misquoted me. And sometimes they're receptive and sometimes they're not.
Well, now, the Eagle is very interesting in that I should say there are a number of conflicts in this interview. First of all, potential conflicts. My wife was a professor for 25 years at your...
A valued professor.
Yes, she was. But also I write a weekly column for the Berkshire Eagle, which by no means means that I'm indebted to the Berkshire Eagle, because I'm not. But there is this new model, because papers are going under.
Right.
The Eagle, which you just said was a great paper, has been bought by a bunch of people who have a lot of money and want to do good in their community. Mm. And it works, and they're putting on all kinds of reporters and everybody else. It is a new model for how journalism may get done. Are you watching it?
I am. You know, it's interesting because from a couple of perspectives. So I talked about my older sister, Mary Kate, who's the nun, mm-hmm. right? But my twin sister is a journalist. In fact, she's an associate professor of journalism at William Patterson in New Jersey, but she wrote for newspapers for a very long time. But, you know, growing up, the Berkshire Eagle was the paper that my family got and we read, and I really enjoyed that. And then I was gone for 30 years and, you know, ownership changed. And when I came back in the spring of 16, that was just when the transition was starting. But even as in that transition, when I was reading the paper, it just seemed to lack something. I wasn't sure what it was, but there just didn't seem to be an energy in its story.
Yeah.
And so when this new group took over, almost immediately, it seemed to me there was a change back to what the paper that I knew, which was really focused on local activities, local stories that are important to the communities. And I have to say, I've really been enjoying the Eagle in more ways than I thought I would. You know, I really like the focus that they're taking on local community. I think the focus on education, you know, they're highlighting these educational programs every week around the county, or I should say in their readership. And I really like that. I think it's been really helpful. I think their stories have been probative in many ways. When you look at the things related to the gas pipeline and the reporting they've been doing about that, I think it's been really good, solid reporting.
Now, it's a very liberal newspaper now. Are you a liberal?
I think some people would describe me as liberal. Some people would say that I must be a conservative because I dress rather conservatively.
You do. You have a bow tie on right now. People should know that.
Right. But I think of myself as fairly moderate in terms of fiscal affairs, but probably lean more liberal towards social matters.
So the fact that the newspaper is, not to beat this to death, but that the newspaper is so liberal doesn't interfere with your fiscal conservatism, social liberalism?
Fiscal moderate.
Okay.
Not conservative, right? That doesn't skew the way that I read the paper by any means. You know, I like to read in general, and I like to read good writing, whether it's the newspaper or nonfiction or fiction. I don't let, you know, my political ideology direct how I'm going to interpret some reading. I like to read it for what it is. So that doesn't get in the way. It's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about it, but that doesn't necessarily get in the way for me.
So the fact that you know some substantive subjects, obviously we all do, better than others, means that your relationship with faculty members has to be a little different, because in each case, you may know more about politics than you do about economics. But you have to make decisions on these people's lives and their promotions and all the rest of it. How do you make up for deficiencies?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think any academic president is going to acknowledge that there are some areas that are not as strong for her or him than others. And again, I think that's one of the benefits of our model of higher education in the United States, is that we have processes that help reveal some of these things. So, for example, a tenure case in a discipline that I may not know something about, let's pick as your example, is economics. You know, I'll rely on a variety of factors: student evaluations, the promotion and tenure committee, the recommendation from the dean and or provost, and then ultimately what I know about that person and how he or she has accomplished the criteria for tenure. I think those are the things that are spelled out in a tenure portfolio. I am not the kind of person that thinks that personal interaction with a faculty member should determine whether or not someone gets tenure or how they've behaved outside of the role that they have as a faculty member. I don't think those things should come into it. I think it really is about the emergence of the information that comes from the portfolio that that faculty member has developed and the external evaluations from students and colleagues to say this person is worthy of a permanent appointment at the institution. So I rely on that quite heavily.
So Dr. Jamie Burge, I say that in case people are joining us. Let me ask you this. Do you ever find that you are dependent on student evaluations, which you just mentioned? And okay, I know this is going to sound bad, but I was a very popular professor.
I was. I have no doubt.
And I did extremely well in all student evaluations. But there are those people who, other professors along the way, who thought that, you know, this stuff was just a road to disaster. Because if you wanted to give somebody the D that they deserved in the class or the F that they deserved, you were always worrying, looking over your shoulder, what they were going to say about mm-hmm. you in your either rate my professor or in your evaluations.
Right.
How do you answer that?
Well, I think it's about looking at patterns, too. You know, there may be an evaluation from a student that is just terrible, just a very bad evaluation of a faculty member. And I think it's important to look at that. But for me, it's about what's the pattern? What are others saying about the faculty member? What's the weight of evidence that says this person is should be considered for tenure or not? But that's only one part of it, right? I think that student voice is important in that, but it's not the only element for making a consideration
of
tenure.
I'm sorry, Jamie. Do you think hard professors are always downgraded on because of the potential for a grade? Or do you think that there's respect for hard professors?
I think there's respect for hard professors. I think absolutely that, you know, those faculty members that set the bar high, more often than not, students rise to that level. I absolutely think that they see that. Now, I think that students will gripe about that. Oh, God, that faculty member, she is just so hard. She's unreasonable. But in the long run, I think that student says that was the best course that I took.
Sure.
I absolutely believe that. I see that. That was my own experience. I'll be very frank. There was a course when I was in school that I failed. And, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes students will say, well, that faculty member gave me an F. But if the student gets an A, the student says, I earned an A. I got an A, right? There's a qualitative shift in that. Well, I got the F, right? I earned that F. I just didn't do what I needed to do. But when it came time to take the course again, and the faculty member was very good. It wasn't for lack of expertise in the content area. It wasn't for lack of the ability to teach well. It was just that I wasn't committed to the education in that course that I should have been. And so when it came time to, I had to take that course again, I took it from the same professor and did very well. But I knew that that faculty member had something to teach me. I just wasn't, at that moment, I wasn't ready to listen or willing to listen. But I took it again. And I'm absolutely grateful to that faculty member for having taken the time to let me get into the course again and to let me have that second chance.
Okay, Dr. Jamie Burge, I'm going to ask you a question. What gets you angry?
Yeah, you know, there's probably a number of things. I think the unfair evaluations of people get me angry when people jump to conclusions about an individual, either because of something somebody else said or not having a lot of, you know, I get frustrated by that. I guess that's probably more.
Could you be a little bit more specific?
You know, you had said earlier in our conversation, you know, so somebody comes up to you and whispers into your ear that this person isn't very good.
Right.
I guess I'm frustrated by that because, you know, I wonder how that person arrived at that determination. Did they take the time to get to know who that person was? And, you know, there are times, and in your example, maybe that was the case, but there are times when I think people jump to conclusions about others, and I think it's unfair. And I just get really frustrated by that. So I think that's an example of what makes me angry.
Although I would say to you, Jamie, that if I take a look at a high school, for example, mm-hmm. every student and every teacher could tell you who the weak people were mm-hmm. on the faculty at the high school. It was general knowledge, and I have to say, I really believe it was true. So your recalcitrance in terms of not liking people whispering this stuff in your ear may not serve you well or serve the students well if it annoys you. In other words...
Well, no, I didn't mean to say that I don't like when people whisper in my ear. I'm fine with that. I don't like when people whisper in my ear and they expect me to dislike someone or to make a judgment about someone based on what they've said, as opposed to giving me the opportunity to have my own experience of that individual. So when people would expect me just to make a decision based on something that they said, even if it's from somebody that I highly respect, generally I get frustrated when people expect me to do that because I think that I'm a good judge of character. And when people don't allow me to have the opportunity to judge that character, that's what frustrates me.
We're speaking to Dr. Jamie Burge of the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the president there. And very kind of you, Jamie, to give us all of this time. I always appreciate that. So is there anything else that annoys you?
I think I'm awfully patient. I think I'm a good listener. So I don't think that I get annoyed easily.
Are you a gardener?
I am a pseudo gardener. My wife is a fairly significant gardener, and so I tag along with her.
Do you worry about ticks?
In fact, I do. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, I was diagnosed with Lyme's disease.
No.
So I'm doing the antibiotics, doxycycline right now and trying to kick this thing around. But, you know, I've always been an outdoors person. And actually, I'm surprised this is the first time in my life that I've had this because I've done a lot
of...
Well,
no, they really are.
But there is a fairly significant population of ticks right now. But, you know, that's part of experience, right? I mean, you know, that's some risk that you take if you're going to be in the outdoors in the Northeast where there are ticks. You can either choose not to go into the woods or do hiking or biking or whatever you're going to do because you're fearful of getting Lyme's disease, or you can just say, I'm going to do the best that I can to mitigate it and not have it happen.
Are you a hunter?
I'm not.
Why not?
You know, my parents never wanted me to have a gun. I grew up in where I grew up in Lee. A number of my friends were hunters.
Oh, yeah.
But my parents didn't want me to have a gun, and I never really was very intrigued by that. Now, I love to fish. I'm an avid fly fisherman, and that came out of my youth with my friends. And so I love finding the rivers around, certainly in northern Berkshire County, but never been a hunter.
I want to return to the beginning, your Catholic education and upbringing. Is there any principle... You know, I mean, I interviewed Mario Cuomo for a lot of years. And we talked a lot about some of his influences, Teilhard, Desjardins, and others who were so important to him. But is there...
Jesuit, by the way.
Yes.
Teilhard Desjardins.
Yeah. But is there anything in your, what you've assumed from your religion that becomes formulative in who you are today that you want to talk about?
Oh, I think there's a lot, frankly.
So, for example...
So, I have a real commitment to public service. I try to volunteer. I don't do as much volunteer with direct service right now that I used to. I'm doing more on board service and things like that. But that's really important to me. And that directly comes out of, I think, my upbringing in the Catholic faith. It comes directly from my parents who were active volunteers in their communities. That's something that's really important to me. I think being contemplative is something that is important to me, and that comes out of considering scripture and thinking about what faith means, and even the ritual of Mass for the Catholics.
Do you ever have any disagreement with the intellectual positions of the Church? Now, you know we're going to go to abortion, so I'll tell you that right now. Does the lay Catholic have a right to say no, that I'm not going along with this?
Going along with?
Whatever the dogma or... Specific,
absolutely.
Yes.
I think that from my upbringing, I'll talk about me as opposed to Catholics in general. I don't want to speak on their behalf, but... You know, my background, I think, is to be thoughtful about those things. And when I look at this issue of abortion, I absolutely think that women have the right to decide what happens with their bodies, without question. And I don't think that that is a rejection of faith by any means. And there are many people who are going to disagree, and maybe you'll get phone calls or I'll get letters.
You won't.
But I think fundamentally that a woman has the right to choose to do with her body what she wants. And I think that's what the Catholic faith is really. That's something that gets downplayed.
Well, when Mario Cuomo, you know, made virtually this, he gave a very famous speech at Notre Dame, and he made much of that kind of point. Mm-hmm. There was a bishop in lower New York who said he'll burn in hell forever. Does that...
Well, I'm glad I'll have good company.
I mean, do you have the sense that the Church... See, in Judaism, the rabbi can't say to you, you'll burn in hell forever. But there's a hierarchy in Catholicism.
Yeah, sure.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, I guess I deal with it by thinking that I think of God as loving and graceful and forgiving. And I don't believe that because of the position that I have, that I'm going to be condemned to hell. I think that when that day comes, hopefully a long way from now, that I'll be judged for being a very good person and honoring my faith and... that the values that I uphold are the values of love and the right that somebody has to make decisions about their own life.
So St. Joe's, the Catholic high school in Berkshire County, has been closed by the diocese because they ran out of students, basically.
Yeah, sure.
You went to St. Joe's?
I did not. Okay. I went to Lee High School.
Lee High School. Is Catholicism in trouble as a result of, you know, all the stuff that we've seen, you know, the pedophilia, all the rest of this stuff? Are we on a downward slope? What do you make of all that?
Well, I think that it is a horrible, horrible era for the Catholic Church, given all of the crimes committed by priests and, to a certain degree, some nuns involving children. Just awful. That's unforgivable. And I think that has discouraged Catholics, some Catholics, from their practice of their faith. But I also think that, you know, when we think about the larger context of our faith, it's life-giving for us, and that it's something that we rely on. I think with our current Pope Francis, a former Jesuit, you know, he's brought more focus on social justice and love and peace to the papacy than we've seen expressed in this way in a very long time. I think other popes have had their own way of expressing those things, and they've been valuable, but this particular pope speaks to me in ways that are important because of my understanding about justice.
Speaks to me, too.
Yeah, great.
That's right. Well, I have to say this has been a delight, and you've been such a good sport answering my questions. Dr. James Burge, is the president of MCLA, otherwise known as the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, and you're always welcome back here. And if you ever have something that you want to say, come and say it on our air. We'd love to have you do it.
It's Thank you.
Great to talk to you, and thanks for this remarkable interview.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.